Welcome to What CEOs Talk About. Do you wonder what CEOs talk about behind closed doors? How they bring their vision to reality? How do they overcome and succeed through adversity? We share that and so much more with each episode. Now, let's get started with the show.
Hello, everybody. My name is Martin Hunter. I am the host of What CEOs Talk About, where we translate vision into frontline strategies. Today, Jay, thank you very much for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Martin.
Thank you. Word from our sponsors. Jay, you've owned a lot of businesses, correct?
Yeah. I'd say I've owned a lot of businesses. There's one business that I'm really leaning into right now.
Good. And you've sold a few of those businesses, right? You've exited out of a few businesses, right?
Yeah. I like to say is I bought the URL and sold the URL and gone through the roller coaster journey from start to the end.
When you were exiting or prior to exiting, what was the good and the bad? Like, do you remember good experiences and bad experiences?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of excitement at the good. I mean, you have these ideas. You're absolutely full of optimism, and so that's a really contagious and fun feeling that goes in. I mean, there's a little bit of ego, maybe naivety, mixed with just self-righteousness in the sense that you're going to build something that the world wants. That's a lot of fun. That's infectious. And often you can do it by yourself. And in my case, it's always been with partners. So there's a collaborative mindset in terms of like, we're going to go out there and team up and do this. So that's fun. That's a pretty gnarly, awesome feeling. I think that there's a lot of entrepreneurs that live and eat and breathe that. And they felt that only to kind of move on. And you realize often, and this is just my case, is that, you know, you get hit with market and the realities of going to market and trying to find product market fit or a sight line to product market fit or your first customers. And so that ends up becoming the challenge and the exciting aspect of it. And so that is the hard stuff. And I often say this, if it was easy, everyone would do it. And so that's the fun. And I think all of it's exciting, actually. I don't think I have anything negative about entrepreneurialism, or else I probably would have stopped.
One thing that Jay mentioned, I don't know if you guys paid attention, is that you have to find the right partners into doing that. There's no way that you can do it by yourself. I've exited two companies of my own and a whole bunch of others. And having the right partner, and there's a couple of gems in what Jay said about operating the business properly. So you might be the entrepreneur, you might have great ideas, but operating a business is not easy. So one of the things that Urgio does really well is help you operate those businesses. They are operators by nature and therefore can help you really get down on the nitty-gritty of really translating that vision to frontline operations. So key out, thank you very much, Urgio, for sponsoring this message. Thank you. So Jay, what is the title of the show? What did we agree on? Something like...
When doing these podcasts, I always think about what type of value I love to listen to, and the value what I think that I've learned and really come away with is redeveloping my relationship with failure. Mm-hmm. And so if there was a title, I would say failure is a data point, and then we can maybe peel that onion a little bit and understand exactly what that means. I don't romance it, but I celebrate it. I understand that is the forcing function of a tool needed in order for success. So failure is a data point, if you will.
Absolutely. I think there's too much hype around failure, right? So many people, I go fail. Well, failures, when you fail too many times, you just don't become anything. So I think I'm agree with you. Like, don't romanticize failure, because you're just going to keep on failing. So Jay, can you introduce yourself? Can you give us your full name, what you are, and then tell us your journey? Because I think one thing that the listeners really like is hearing the context. Where did you grow up? How did you grow up? It kind of gives full feel for who the guest is.
Sure. Hi, folks. Well, my name is Jay Ashpalmer. I'm proudly born in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. So I'm a prairie boy by heart and by nature. It's where I started my first company. I was in university, the Reader's Digest version of the story is I was working at a clothing store, and my partner at the time, which was my first business partner, we were both working at a sidewalk sale in the mall, and there's a problem that we wanted to solve, and the problem was this, is that we kind of pretty much glorified security people for the sidewalk sale, and the problem that we wanted to solve at that time was we wanted to meet girls, party, and drink beer, and so that's our 20-year-old self.
I was going to say, every boy's dream, right?
Yeah. So, you know, fast forward a little bit, we applied for a BDC student business loan. It was $3,000 at that time, and you know, I'm going to date myself a little bit, and that was in 97. And so, yeah, that's going back, 1997. And then we got the student business loan for $3,000. We went then to pawn shops and bought a whole bunch of DJ equipment, not knowing how we even put the stuff together. We pitched the student paper, and they did a whole front page article on us. And you know, we went from making $50 a day to making $500 a night. Fast forward a little bit, we started putting on our own events. Fast forward a little bit, at that time there was a big problem. The problem was, and again, I'm going to date myself, is that we had to go out there and sell tickets, but we'd have to go to record stores and provide the tickets to the record store and then try and get the money. So it was really hard to go out there and do any type of budgeting in terms of how many people came up in cash flow and all the different stuff. So at that time, I wanted to solve my own problem and scratch my own itch, which decided to build a startup, and startups weren't called startups. So there's, it was a tech company. So it was an online ticketing and event management company. The company was called Pick a Tick. Subsequently, they had big ambitions to, grow a company that penetrated the world, which we did. I'm happy to say that led it to acquisition in 2018. So a company called Eventbrite acquired us, which was
just
really
a little,
fun.
Just this little company.
Yeah. That's from a Saskatchewan boy to that, it's quite a journey. I was on the inside and got to see a company go public shortly after. I think it was like 60 days after they acquired us. So
oh, no way.
Got to see the public process. I'm building another company with my wife. It's a CPG, consumer packaged good, direct to consumer company, and that's just a really fun experience. In between there, I built some commercial, did some real estate, all that other stuff. So, that's been the fun process of building and scaling companies.
And the current company is the sexiest tongue scraper out there, Gunky. Gunky.com, double I, right? GUNKII.com, right?
Yeah. I mean, and people, how do you go from a tech company to a tongue scraper? And some people haven't even heard of a tongue scraper. So I really quickly, I'll just talk about it, is that during COVID, I had an opportunity to sit at home and reevaluate, post-exit of a tech company, what I wanted to do. And I saw my wife, and I got to see, double-click on her career. And she is a top 40 under 40 performance marketer, makes up millions of dollars. I was like, hey, listen, I really want to work with her and spend more time at home. And I saw, predicted that the forcing functions after COVID is going to be more, distributed teams, being able to kind of work, through automation of technology, et cetera, et cetera. So I pitched, and it sounds really, really weird, Martin, but I love tongue scraping. It's a very Indian thing. So as an Indo-Canadian, I've had tongue scrapers in my house my whole entire life. My parents have been doing it for 50 years.
Really? I did not know that. I didn't know that tongue scraping was like an Indian thing.
It's been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years through the Ayurvedic medicine. So it's nothing that we invented. For those people that don't know, there's a layer of gunk on your tongue. It's disgusting. We call it disgustingly satisfying. We built a tongue scraper, the world's sexiest, and you scrape it off. And so far, we've sold it to 50 countries around the world, and we're having a ball doing it.
The one thing that went when we met at one of the dinners, I think that it's worthwhile, is you had before you started before you started the company, it's not like you said, oh, I'm going to sell tongue scrapers. You said to me, and it really caught my ear, it was like, I want to be able to run my business from my phone. And that resonated with me.
Yeah. Like, listen, I mean, in 2000 and in seven, when we started Pick-A-Tick, I had this idea as a Saskatchewan boy. It's like, I want to go out there and sell ones and zeros, and sell while I'm sleeping, mm-hmm. you know? And so I didn't know how I was going to do it. And, you know, to back things up a little bit, I was like, oh, this is where I see the forcing function of where the world is going. Mm-hmm. And I, at that time, I got a lot of pushback. I mean, you got to remember, this was the time where the internet was kind of just coming into play, and asking people to put in their credit card on the internet was, mm-hmm. you know, people thought it was doing a scam. And then also tickets were, you know, paper tickets were like the big thing. And I was like, well, no, you don't actually need a ticket. You need, you know, you could use your phone, or you actually have to print your own tickets. And they're like, you're going to make us print our own tickets. It was like, it was just like this, you know, this really wild concept at that time. I mean, now it's like, it's kind of common sense. Like, if you're not going to send my tickets to my phone, I'm not going to go drive to a box office to do it. And so the forcing function of with this company is like, hey, listen, I think the, you know, what's going to happen, I think we're seeing it, is that we can work wherever there's good Wi-Fi. And you and I are talking right now with, you know, in different parts of the world, or at least in the different parts of the city. And it's just because of the function of good technology and Wi-Fi. So the idea of it is like, hey, how do we create something where we can effectively run our company through phones and using, you know, automation and the technologies that help us and let us do that. And then also have talent work, distributed team, and working not, you know, per hour, but per KPIs, and working through executing on goals rather than, you know, coming from 9 to 5. So that's kind of like peeling the onion a little bit in terms of, you know, want to build it so that you can run from the phone. But that's kind of the ideology around that.
Yeah. I mean, when you were talking about Pick-A-Tick there, there's how many times have you seen in somebody's album pictures or photo albums, they say, oh, these are my tickets to the concert to Aerosmith. These are my tickets concert to, you know, The Wall, Pink Floyd. And there's memorabilia that is attached to that. So there's a big cultural change, because I went to 4 different events within a month, maybe, all on my phone. And it's just the culture has changed so much behind it. I can just imagine how, when you first started, let's bring it back to failure as a data point. So first time you set it up, failure. I'm not buying that. That's you know, that's a scam. When you first started and people think you're scamming them, I mean, failure should have come fast and furious at the start, right?
It did. I mean, I got a lot of no's in terms of, one, there's a lot of folks that I thought, in terms of associations and just event organizers, I thought that would adopt to it really quickly. And so there's just people that, like you said, that thought it was a scam. The one good thing about Saskatchewan is a very handshake community. So we have a lot of folks that knew me by reputation, which was good. The conversation I had with them is like, well, how about I come in and actually work the door, and I'll do all the work. So there's a lot of times early that I end up actually working the door, helping them organize their event in order to just come in. And what I had to do is I had to go out there and prove out value consideration, is what I like to call it. I didn't know the word at that time or what that really meant, but is kind of show to them exactly what this was and what this did. And that really helped kind of have a tipping point, if you will, to get adoption. Once people started to see the value, and they started to use it, it ended up becoming, you know, there ended up becoming a viral coefficiency to it. And what happened was, is people then would start promoting, get your tickets at Pick-A-Tick, and that created confidence, and that's how it all started. But if I would have stopped with the first 100 no's, I definitely would have, you know, it would have been done before it even started, if you will.
What was the term that you used? Value?
Value consideration.
Consideration. Oh, yeah. So that is the Apple versus bushel, right? Here's an apple, but here's an apple. Taste the apple. If you like the apple, then buy the bushel. Value consideration. That was a good way also to kind of associate yourself and reduce the risk, right? When I'm thinking about it, why did they not want, what was the behavior behind it? And I said, well, I think you're scamming them. Well, you can't scam them. Well, people feel less less vulnerable when you're standing there as well. I can actually grab him. And, you know, if I get scammed, I can get a hold of him physically. I can hold him, right?
It worked out. It worked out great in all aspects. I mean, when we first started, you know, having that viral loop of being able to iterate on what the customer wanted, and the customer in our set was the promoter. As we grew to an international company, it was very difficult for somebody to give us that real-time feedback if they're in Australia versus, you know, in the early days where people had my cell phone and be like, yo, Jay, this is broken, or you know what, we need this. And then I'd be like, yeah, no worries. Thank you for letting us know. We're going to put that into our pipeline and we'll work around that now. So it's just a really fun. And I mean, being close to your customer is, you know, there was a lot of value. And that's, you know, one thing I learned from that is just being able to iterate so quick because of that.
It's, we always say the definition of operational excellence is a mindset of an organization to be able to see, deliver, and improve the value flow to customer. And I think too many times when an organization scales, they forget how close they have to stay, even if the organization grows and grows and grows, how closely you have to be, you know, you have to be like an arm's length away from your customers to be able to do that, to be able to hear. Now, you might not be able to change that overnight because turning a cruise ship is a lot different than turning, you know, a tinny with, you know, a smaller boat. It can still be done. It is not as quick, but being able to understand, recognize, and be close to the value that you add to your customers, regardless, I think this is like a key message that you're sending out there.
I'll tell you something. As we grew, I would continue working the door. I'd be continually going to events and seeing, and I'd stand by the often. I mean, people would be, you know, some people would just look at me at sometimes, like if I didn't rearrange it, I'd just sort of stand by and hover and just kind of take a look at how people were being checked in and around that process. And people would be like, "Hi, can we help you?" I'm just like, that would explain who I am. And they'd be a little bit shocked that I'm, you know, at that point, it was like, "Oh, you're that interested in, you know, you really are the CEO of the company?" I'm like, "Yeah, you know," and I'd interview them and what their experience was. But you can still be involved. You can be involved on every aspect of your company. I think, you know, they start taking a life of their own, and it's really easy to go out there and get locked away and have an arm's reach. But that's something I think I would shed a bit of modesty. I did really well, is keep my hands dirty and keep my hands really, really close to or my ears close to the customer.
It's so I've worked with large organizations like Lourdes, with BNSF Railways, with Tyson Foods, and I would always urge, I say, let's go for a walk. Let's fly down here. Let's fly down to Center, Texas or Carthage, Mississippi with the leadership team. And let's just go. Let's go see what happens. Is that really valuable? Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Go out there and they'll see you and they'll go, who are you? You introduce yourself and just watch, and just your presence alone of saying, so there's three human needs that a lot of people forget. And when you do business, it is critical to, as the CEO, to let people three things. I see you, I hear you, you matter to me. So if you're the CEO sitting at an event and you're watching these people, what does that, and they, Hey, who are you? Well, I hear you, right? Well, I've been watching you because it's really important for me to know what difficulties you're faced with when you're doing this, because I care about how you operate, right? If you have to deal with a customer, a ticket holder that's not, or the system or the process is not really working well, you're the one that's going to have to deal with this. So I'm here to watch. How do I help you? There's this power, Jay, that I think you did really, really well. And I think that should be celebrated as well.
I appreciate that. No, it's, and I mean, it's not something that you fake either. I think you really, you know, I think that I would say that, you know, throughout the journey of being a CEO, my EQ, it was a muscle that I needed to work on and did work on and continually did work on. And that's, I think, part of that whole entire process is just understanding that we're in a people business, and making sure that, you know, we are continually being connected as much as we possibly can at every stage.
a lot of people wouldn't think about that. What is it that you're doing? You are enabling somebody who enjoys an event to be able to participate in that event. Most out of, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's a human being delivering, singing, saying, you know, whatever event there is, hockey, football, whatever the event, there's human beings, and therefore there's human beings wanting to watch other human beings. And you're just facilitating that process through pick and tick, right? When you think about it.
Well, and I never looked at it as just. I thought it was a really strong, powerful responsibility. I mean, you know, when I think about events, I thought of it and I've always looked at it as like, hey, this is where somebody might go and have a lifetime memory that they're never going to forget. Mm-hmm. This is where they might go and meet the love of their life or their business partner. This is where they're going to go out there and be inspired to have a new career. This is where they're going to learn a piece of information that's going to help them save their life or somebody else's life. And the way I looked at events was that connectivity and that connectivity between human information and love is something that we took deeply we took it really seriously. That's the word I'm looking for. I didn't know if there's more of a serious word than seriously, but I'll use seriously. We took it extremely seriously, and that's something that helped us fuel to go out there and build something that I think people really appreciated.
It's so true, right? Oh, where'd you guys meet? Well, we went to a concert together, and then how long have you been married? 30 years.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. How many times did you hear that? Or, hey, man, remember when we went to that hockey game and this, there's just, you're right. There's, I mean, transactionally, it's just this little window, but the connectivity between the human beings is just absolutely immense. You're 100% right.
I mean, and to the listeners right there, you know, even if this quick little challenge, if I ask you this question, if you think about your, you know, your top 10 life memories and you think about them, often there's going to be some memories in there that are associated to going to an event.
Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah, being at your, so you know, and for me, it was my son's first, you know, holiday concert and seeing him on stage. And just being able to go out there, obviously not a ticketed event, but it was an event and a gathering of people. But that's one life memory that's, you know, hopefully will not be taken away from me. But it's something that I'll cherish, and it's worth more than $1 million.
I 100% agree. So let's talk about your views on failure. Why did you pick that title?
Well, you know, one is I speak to a lot of young entrepreneurs now. Mm-hmm. Just an opportunity to go out there and perhaps, you know, give back to so many people that have given to me. But one of the things that when we talk to young entrepreneurs, and this is something maybe specifically to Saskatchewan or more specifically to myself, but in a handshake community, what was really difficult was a sense of failing, you know, just because everyone kind of knows who your business. It's just a mm-hmm. small community. And not until I moved to San Francisco, I realized and redeveloped my relationship with failure and understanding that failure is just a data point. Mm-hmm. It's not something, again, it's not something that I romance. It's not something that I overly celebrate. I understand it's a forcing function. It's a tool in order to go out there and be successful. When I was down in the valley, something that really dawned on me is when I was talking to all these founders is that they would wear their failures with a badge of honor, you know, opposed to hiding and being ashamed of it. In fact, I am not ashamed of my failures. In fact, that is kind of where the genius of whatever my ability is really comes out. And I mean, we want to fail fast, fail cheap, all the cliches, all that other stuff, but it's just really going out there and living in that world of really being able to iterate and understanding that's all just a process of the journey. And for me, I think that there's a lot more failures than there are success until you do get that success. So when I going back and understanding and talking to entrepreneurs is understanding that failure is a data point is something that I just really want to make sure that is, you know, when they're starting this is that when we, in what we alluded to at the earlier, Martin, is when we first started, we have these ambitions of being super successful and it's going to be this, you know, straight line to success, which it is anything but. And when we learn that these data points are, you know, the tools that's necessary for us to go out there and to be successful. That's kind of, you know, what I really want to make sure that new entrepreneurs really understand. And I think the big tool around that is perseverance. When you get into those moments, you know, those spots.
Yeah, I agree. There's too many times nowadays in the common language or the super popular words, you know, fail and fail. Failing is never fun. And you should, let's clarify this. You should not aim to fail, right? The point is to analyze areas of improvement. And I think that the continuous improvement cycle is what people should understand, is that without good planning, so when you look at the continuous improvement cycle of plan, do, track, adjust, we tend to, as entrepreneurs, go straight to do and adjust, do and adjust, do and adjust, do and adjust, and we forget that there's two key components that are strategic and not tactical, is planning and tracking. And so either or, there has to be a percentage of attention given, because failing just to fail is stupid. If you fail and you learn, so you plan, you do, you track, you adjust. Then you come back and you say, okay, where did I fail? How did I fail? What was the cause of it? Maybe it wasn't me. Maybe it was just the market. How many times have you seen somebody go to market? They've done everything right, but the market is just not ready for them. Mm-hmm. Or they're in the wrong vertical. They're in the wrong area. So no matter how much you want to swing the bat and hit a home run, if you're hitting a wiffle ball, it's not going to go out. Like the ball doesn't have enough bump to it to be able to knock it out of the park. So I think that there's a lot of times where, personally, the way that you say it is key, is that without tracking the failure, there is no way to improve. There's no way to learn. There's no way to do it. So just don't just do and fail, do and fail. That's my personal opinion anyways.
How I speak about it is failure is a data point. It is a data point, and it's the tracking of the data. And to iterate on it. I mean, you can do small batch tests. You can do variant testing. You can go out there and being agile about it is extremely important. And understanding that's the recipe for success. There's often, I think, like, you know, just backing this up, Martin, I think there's an assumption that you and I are making, is that, you know, CEOs, I would suspect that it's inherent in them. They generally will go and do that. It's just part of their DNA and their makeup. But there's just a large subset of folks that really want to get into business and, you know, feel like they have to have all the pieces of the puzzle all mapped out prior to, and just, it doesn't work that way. You know, there's going to be a plan. There is going to be, an execution, implementation, et cetera, et cetera. And you're going to go through that, but it is going to be one of these roller coaster rides, in understanding that these data points, are just an important piece. And in fact, the DNA of being able to go out there and ride this roller coaster of building something that people find value in.
What is the biggest learning, or let's call it this way, what's the most impactful failure that gave you the biggest learning experience that dictates who you are today?
I'll tell you, I'm not sure if this answers that question, but I'll tell you one thing where I end up getting panic attacks and hives and discoloring of my skin. And so... So this is when I was in Saskatchewan. It was listed as one of the top 10 by Alberta Venture Magazine as, you know, people to know, et cetera, and do business with. And it was really easy being a big fish in a small pound, if you will, for, you know, if that was the case. But in my head, that was. And so got an opportunity to move to San Francisco, go down there. That was an eye-opening experience. And the best way to explain this is, you know, I'm Canadian, and for the, I'm going to use a sports analogy, but being a really good hockey player in Guatemala and then coming up to Canada and then realizing the kids playing shinny in the streets are better than you. You know, and that's what it was like when I went down to San Francisco. I got my, you know, part of my French, my ass handed to me. I was completely out of scope. I didn't understand exactly, you know, the signaling, the nuances. It's not that I had didn't have the ability, but I just, like, there was just so much I needed to learn. And it kept me up at night. It gave me panic attacks. I shed a lot of tears. Again, not romancing any of this. That's where, you know, I wanted to pack my bags up many times and just quit. But, you know, one conversation to another and continually being, you know, having the perseverance. That was probably the biggest, tipping point in terms of like, okay, I hit a brick wall and it's time, you know, a lot of people tell me it's time to pack up and, you know, you're a Me Too company and or you're out of scope, you don't have enough funding, X, Y, and Z in terms of why this isn't going to work. And so that's kind of, and then when, you know, we're talking to some, you know, during that same time, I remember talking to some investors and, you know, some of the harshest feedback I got was that was the worst pitch I've ever heard in my life. And it's because I didn't know how to pitch. And so anyways, if there is a way to go out there and answer that, getting knocked down a lot right before we even started, even after we had product market fit. Hopefully that answers your question.
Well, yeah. I mean, so from what I hear is not the biggest failure, but the biggest obstacle that you were faced with was like, okay, I'm a success in Saskatchewan. I'm going down to Silicon Valley. I'm going to play. And then you get there and you realize, holy shit, I am nobody compared to all of these. And everybody's thumbing you down. Everybody's thumbing you down. And the lesson that you learned was what you said before. Just show up. Yeah. Just show up. Just show up.
Yeah, just perseverance. And listen, when I look back at it, nobody was wrong. I went to one networking event, and I was talking to the CEO, who's a prestigious CEO at the time in the Valley. In Saskatchewan, we generally often talk about the weather, the family, who we know of, and we have the small talk. When I went down there, I ended up having that type of small talk with the CEO, and he effectively looked at me and just said, listen, you're not ready. You're not ready, and you shouldn't be here right now. You need to go home and practice and get your impact statement. And I was deeply, deeply hurt, extremely offended. My pride took a hit.
A big hit.
Only to realize later on is that CEO was giving me radical candor and really helped me out. We now laugh about it, but the reality of it is that radical candor and the data point was I wasn't ready. Market dictated that. The ecosystem told me that. And what I need to do is I need to iterate. I need to go out there and learn. I need to go out there and understand where my gaps were. And that was all part of the process. And it was just a data point that I could just learn from, iterate from, and put my ego and humility off to the side and understand this is just a process and perseverance. I never knew that was the biggest tool that I needed to go out there and leverage at the time. But like now I know is that perseverance and just showing up, as you say, it's 90% of the battle. Just get up and chop wood, carry water, chop wood, carry water, chop wood, carry water.
I love that one. I love that one. Chop wood, carry water. I love that one. We always say, I always tell my kids when they play sports and they get it. I said, hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. And I said, you don't have to be the best. You don't have to be the best. All you have to do is show up and give it. When you get knocked on, both of my kids play rugby, United Rugby Club. Both of my kids play rugby. I coach both of them. My daughter just made the provincials, which is, nice. State. Yeah, pretty good for a 13-year-old going on 14. We call my kids Beauty and the Beast. Gavin is the beauty. Ariel's the beast. she's an animal. She's a gorgeous kid and solid and strong and plays with heart and devotion. And that's the thing, right? Is that we always tell my kids, don't believe in magic, believe in hard work. And I say hard work, I'm not saying, you know, do crazy hours, but when you do show up, put in 100%, right? And if you get beat, you get beat. And if you get knocked on your ass, what'd you do wrong, right? Get back up, consistent, right? The one thing that I have learned through the years, and there's a great book by James Clear, Atomic Habits, is that consistency is key to success, right? You don't have to do much. Like atomic, like small nuclear kind of size things can be an atomic event if you've read the book, for others who haven't. How to compound behaviors. And I think consistency, I think, is what you've done. That persistence of saying, okay, great, showed up, got my ass whooped. Okay, so how do I learn from, how do I build a better deck, right? What's the one thing that you feel, so for me, my biggest failure to set you up right now is I'm in a point in my life where financially, emotionally, everything is really comfortable. Mm-hmm. And what I'm afraid most of is, can I be a center of influence? And I'm 50 years old this year. I was 50 years old, so I'm going to 51. And the biggest thing that's really haunting me now is this imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. Like, I've reached, I've achieved, I've done all of this. Then I look at everybody else that's talking, and I'm like, who am I to tell people what to do and how to do it? And that scares the shit out of me, in all honesty. What's you? Because you've achieved a very good level of success. You're comfortable. You've got, you're healthy, I'm assuming, as well, and everything's going well. What are you afraid of?
Hey, listen, comfortability is what I'm extremely afraid of. And I will,
you too, right?
I will dive into this a little bit more, and what that means. One is that, when that transition of moving from Saskatchewan to the Valley and going through all this whole entire process, is I've realized that when I was most uncomfortable and when I had all these, scary moments, that's when I end up actually making change and have the best growth. And and that's where, life happened. And I found my success. And now my new comfortability is being uncomfortable, opposed to comfortable. Now, with, with success, whatever that looks like, but let's say it's economic success, maybe it's, career success, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. It can revert back and push you into that safe zone in terms of being comfortable. And mm-hmm. I think I'm with you a little bit, and what you say echoes with me in the sense of, like, there have been times where I definitely have become a little too comfortable, which has made me uncomfortable. Now, my life now is trying to not be busy, not have my calendar full, not go out there and chase my tail. I redefine what I think success looks like and what wealth is, and is it on my terms? So understanding exactly that new ideology of what wealth is and still keeping myself uncomfortable is where I'm trying to find that good balance. And that doesn't mean that my calendar's booked, and that doesn't mean that I have this, self-importance of having to be on a stage or having to be, leading the charge every time. So if that's kind of some of the things that maybe, you're leaning towards or you're talking about. I mean, I'm with that. And maybe it's because, I'm on the same vintage as you, Martin. Maybe that's just a little bit of, dare I say, midlife, dilemmas, if you will.
Yeah. For me, the biggest thing is I grew up not a lot of money. I make fun of it. I say sometimes I grew up so poor, we were poor. We couldn't afford the R at the end of R, at the end of poor. I'm the baby of six. And so demand breeds creativity, right? When you don't have a lot, then it breeds creativity. I mean, I remember some of the stuff that I did when I was a kid. That was like awful. We would go into the richer neighborhood, raid the gardens, come back to the restaurants and sell them to the Asian food, to the Chinese food restaurant. We'd sell the vegetables for half the price. But that's, you know, back then we were, you know, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, that's, you know, the trouble that I would get in. So not that much trouble, but really kind of, hey, it's a business opportunity, yeah. Right? But that defines who I am today as a problem solver. What I'm afraid of is, without being a total douchebag, is how can I be a good father that doesn't put my kids in this too comfortable zone, but comfortable enough so that they don't need anything. It's one of the dilemmas that I'm always in. Same thing with my team is I want to make them comfortable, but not too comfortable, so that they solve their own problems, so that they have their own journeys, right? It's, I don't want to compare kids to staff and team members. It's not the point. Is the methodology of letting them, you said it best, is life happens when you've got that creative challenge to fill, right? That's where life happens. I really like what you said there. So that's what I struggle with as well, is trying to keep my kids comfortable but not too comfortable.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I challenge myself with as well. And ironically, as I look back and do retros on my own life, I those moments of when I was the most uncomfortable and I thought the world was going to die and I was not going to make it and et cetera, those are ironically my proudest moments, because we were able to get
that's
through.
That's so true.
You know? And so, you know, trying to keep myself in those moments without the stress is the balance that I'm trying to work on right now. So I don't have a magic wand for it, but I do know that's, you know, I do get very uncomfortable and I'm very comfortable. And I think I'm happy about that, yeah. Knowing that that's how I intrinsically feel.
Last two questions. What's the piece of reference material prior to today? So before today, what was the Bible, piece of reference, movie that you referred to on a continuous that defined who you are and who you did business as a leader? So for me, prior to today, I loved the movie Master and Commander. It just showed intense purposefulness, leadership, adventure, being on the same ship. There's so much out of that movie that I attached myself and my leadership to. So that was my go-to. Same thing with the 7 Habits, putting first things first. Those are kind of the things that I attached myself to back then. Now I've got Sadhguru, who's a yogi, who just, everything he says is absolutely beautiful and engages me. So what is for you the thing prior to today that you attached yourself to for your leadership and what you did as a CEO? And what's the next thing that you're looking at right now?
Well, I mean, there's one thing that I looked at. I mean, I did the Harvard Business Executive Program, and I took authentic leadership was really what I was driving towards myself. I forget the name of the book and the professor, but we really dove down on authentic leadership. And so I don't know if there's a movie or a show, if you will. And it's skipping my mind right now in terms of the author and the professor's name. But I'll follow up with you on this one here, mm-hmm. in terms of that. But the authentic leadership aspect of the learnings that I've taken out of it and the principles around that is where I go, where I sort of lean towards when you ask that question, and really focusing on the muscle of EQ, emotional intelligence is where I've and so there's a combination of a whole bunch of courses and learnings, so it's not just one piece. It's a complement of a whole bunch of theories, thoughts, and learnings around the one focus of how do I go out there and develop that muscle. So to kind of turn back, maybe that question is the one thing that I work on, and the one thing that I have been really pushing towards is increasing my EQ skill set and muscle. Hopefully that answered the question in some
form. Yeah. And how about now, what's going forward, what's the thing that you've been really, really focusing on? What's the thing that really, that you're attaching your whole being to?
I love the question. Thank you. What I am is I'm really trying to focus on presence. And really focusing on presence. And I realize that, you know, my son's 8 years old. And I realized maybe I have 5 more years until I'm not cool anymore. And I think the biggest value that I think I can provide is being extremely present and spending as much time with him as I possibly can. So I'm, you know, my relationship with wealth has really been changing in terms of what I thought my young person of wealth would want, is the cars and all the fancy stuff and the goods.
Yeah.
That is completely different now. And what is wealth to me is drop off and pick ups. It's being, you know, on the ice with my son and being able to have the coach, being able to go out there and spend time with my family, having the, you know, being able to cook dinners and just being extremely, extremely present. And so that's what I'm really working on is how do I go out there and continually build up a company that penetrates the world, spending more time with my family, at the same time being deeply and extremely present. And that's kind of what I'm really working on right now, you know, opposed to, you know, the killing it culture that I came from in, you know, and working a tremendous amount of hours in being away from it.
Yeah, I hear you.
That's the forcing function of what I'm putting on myself right now. Sorry, it feels like that resonated.
No. It brings it back to, you know, I was asked a question last Friday saying, Martin, what do you do, right? And it's a really good question. It's like, what's at the fundamental of everything that you do? What is it that you want to achieve? It says, for me, prosperity. I've been, you know, saying for a long time, profit plus sustainability equals prosperity. We work from Monday to Friday to be able to pay for our, you know, Saturday, Sunday off. We work a whole bunch, you know, we work half the year, more than the year, to take, you know, a couple of weeks off here and there. Now that variables, but ultimately that prosperity model differs from everybody to, from one person to another. But at the center of everything is that no matter if you're CEO or you're somebody that is just starting off as an employee, is that everybody wants almost the same thing. Everybody wants to be present, be living. So don't think that chasing after money is going to get you there, because, you know, the people that I interview all have achieved financial success and in some way, shape or form. And they're always reverting back, you know, I would trade some of those dollars to be able to spend more time with my family. You know, there. So word of advice for the people who are listening, who are on their way there. Don't forget that today is your today, right? So I tell my kids, today is tomorrow for yesterday, or something like that, or yesterday, today is tomorrow. So no matter how much you view yourself, you put yourself in the future, you are only good as what you do today. So I think it's important that the quality of whatever you feel is important, Jay, the quality of that interaction is pick up and drop off. So for me, that hits home, because I was away sometimes in my corporate life, 8 weeks at a time in Africa, you know, to when I came back and I said, you know, and Tracy, my wife, she says, Martin, it's not the amount of time that you spend, it's the quality of time that you spent with our children, right? So don't be on the phone, don't do this, give them 100%, even if it's for a day or two, at least you're there, you know, wholeheartedly. So that's that kind of wealth and prosperity is more than just dollars, I think, in our opinion.
Yeah, that's, I mean, maybe it's age and wisdom coming, but it's definitely, I resonate with everything that you say. It's, I mean, right now, it's time's my greatest commodity, and so I really want to spend that time and invest that time in these moments. I mean, in the dinner that we had, I mean, for the listeners out there that might be listening, is that I hosted a dinner with another company, and we brought a whole bunch of founders in, and there was no cell phones, nothing like that. It was just good quality, meaningful conversations, and that's really a muscle that I, you know, again, I am trying to develop and continue trying to develop mm-hmm. because I think the ROI on that it's just going to be something that I'm just going to go out there and bask in when I'm in my 80s and my 90s.
I agree. It's will you be remembered by the things around your grave or the things that you've done that led you to the grave? That's what I say all the time.
And hopefully, we make it to our 80s and 90s. I mean, there's a lot of assumptions there.
I'm gonna have a hovercraft because I've got bad hips, so I'm gonna be kind of like a hover wheelchair. I have a plaid, and I'll be this grumpy old 300-year-old guy that just goes around telling kids, "Get out of the way, get out of the way." Jay, thank you so very much for being on the show. It's just lovely. It was nice to see you face to face. It's lovely to chat with you now. You're heading off as well on an adventure with you and your family over the summer holidays.
Yeah. We have a few trips that are planned and exciting. So more quality time.
Fabulous. Are you okay if we put contact details for you below? If anybody is Jay at...
just the letter J at gunki.com. GUNKII.com. And if I can be helpful in any way, don't hesitate to reach out. Love to help wherever I possibly can.
Fabulous. Thank you very much. This is Martin Hunter, the host of What CEOs Talk About, where we translate strategy into frontline operations. Please subscribe, like, and click the notification bell. With that said, thank you very much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks for tuning in to What CEOs Talk About. Make sure to click subscribe to get notified about future episodes or check us out at www.whatceostalkabout.com.